Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. Actually, you are tuning in to the dawn of a new era where, wait for it, Alina and I try and act like grown-ups. So we've kind of been winging this for the last 4 years, and it's about time really that we started treating it like the business that it actually is and being sensible about things. So if you're going to hear some new bits of advertising and bits of information relay an episode, you've hopefully noticed that our sound quality has got much better because Alina's gone off and researched a new platform that we've been using. And yeah, so we're just going to wholly try. Oh, new website as well. Go to historyhack.co.uk. We have a brightly coloured new obnoxious website with funny profiles of the whole team on there. There will be merch as well. Steve is investigating which kind of platform we're going to use to generate that for us, because we don't want to be like printing t-shirts and posting them out. So we're going to let someone else keep most of the money, and it'll mean you get more choice and more different products that you can order, and that we can change things up as regularly as we want as well. If you like us, you can show your appreciation in a number of ways. If you don't want to give us any money, which is fair enough, not everyone does, give us a 5-star shining review on Apple so that more people see us on their podcast feeds. There is an algorithm, apparently. I've heard this on another podcast and I'm going to use it. There's an algorithm and it helps. So if you just go on, give us a 5-star review and say anything, really doesn't matter what you say. You can say, I love Chris Ginger Fuzz, then fine. Doesn't need to be anything constructive. You don't need to blow smoke up our ass, because frankly we don't deserve it. Then if you would like to give us a one-off donation, you can do so on Ko-fi, which is like the equivalent of buying us a coffee. That's how they brand it. So if you go to ko-fi.com/historyhack, you can chuck us like £3 if you enjoy an episode. And that will come across to us, and that would be very much appreciated. If you would like to be our friends and support us on a more regular basis, then you can join our Patreon, which is at patreon.com/historyhack. I've had a lot of fun restructuring the tiers on here. So for £1 a month, I've called this the Van Gogh. I can't remember what my funny logic was for that. But this one is for generous souls that are right there in abject poverty with us. Obviously, there are a lot of women on our team with opinions, clearly witches. For this £1, consider yourself charmed forever against the possibility of German invasion or being beheaded by a fat ginger misogynist. That's Henry VIII, not Chris. As well as our undying gratitude, you'll be entered into a free prize draw every month where we give away books. And we have special Chris perks on each tier as well. Your Chris perk for this one, you'll get your own personal selfie of Chris. And yes, he does requests. I think he'd pretty much do anything. For £5 a month, the Florence Nightingale, you saintly, benevolent and lovely human beings, will also, in addition to everything else, be entered into our free prize draw every month where we give away books. You'll get ad-free content, an invite to a monthly gathering in our virtual pub, the Mary Rose, where you'll get to spend a minimum of 2 hours with hosts and the extended team chewing the historical fat. Your Chris perk for this one, he will read you a personal message at the end of an episode. He is your puppet. Do with him as you will. Our £10 here is called the Mark Twain. This is because you may be upwardly mobile and have some funds right now, but you're clearly fiscally irresponsible if you're slinging them our way. You'll be entered into all of the prize draws and everything with the ad-free content and the monthly gathering. You'll also get 2 exclusive bonus episodes a month and your own personal cartoon of you as your favourite historical character. That's a digital copy of it done by Steve. Our Chris perk for the £10 tier, you'll be eligible for a dinner date with Chris, virtually or in person. You're paying, but don't worry, he's a cheap date. A curry on Uber Eats will do. The £50 tier, we're starting to get to the high rollers now. This is the Mansa Musa. He was a famous king who had a lot of money. We bow before you. We'll be entered into our free prize draw every month. All of the other perks. You'll also be entitled to a free tour in Warsaw, London or Medway with Chris, Self or Alina, depending on where you are. And you'll get your digital copy of your cartoon as well. Also, after 3 months on this tier, you will get a nice framed copy of your digital cartoon as well, personal cartoon. Your Chris perk on this one. We love this one. You get a lock of Chris's glorious ginger hair. This is a limited time only while stocks last. It's vanishing rapidly. Also, if you're a German princess or dressed as Princess Leia, he may even sleep with you as well. So there's lots of reasons to get involved in our Patreon content. Well, you'll notice that we now only do 2 episodes a week on the main feed for free, but there will be lots more content available, different reasons to get involved in that. So if you go to patreon.com/historyhack, then you can do that as well. So that's it. And now we go on to our new episode, and we thought we'd give you a stunning new beginning. And so we've got Saul David with us today. Saul has a new book out that is a history of Britain's airborne services. And if you're asking, do we really need another book about the airborne, then stay tuned, because it turns out that yes, we do. Saul, how are you doing?
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having me back. But I'm now back into the Western theatre chiefly with Sky Warriors. So it might make a bit more sense. And the Americans might be happier too, now that I've moved out of their territory, so to speak.
So I'm moving into it now, so suckers. But yeah, Alina's very excited. You are basically like, would you say, Alina, Saul is like the sex symbol of military historians, isn't he?
Yes, he is. All the girls, I swear to God, every time I go to a festival, oh my God, Saul's here. And then we all go giggly.
Do you know the only man who gets more attention, and it's because he's just so damn suave, is Peter Caddick Adams.
Yeah, yes. He is beautifully dressed, dapper. I have to say. You can't compete with Peter on the kit. I mean, yeah, I do
sorry,
remember...
you look good. You look good, man, but you don't have the cravat.
I mean, I'm not getting any younger, but my daughters found it very funny when about 10 years ago I was doing some TV programme, and the reviewer, who was a bloke, described me as a war historian. They've never let me forget that.
When we get off air, I'm going to tell you what an actual Hollywood person said about me when they were narrating stuff, because it's even cringier than that.
I'm not saying it on air because
it was hideous, but I will tell you. So I'm going to ask a question, first of all, that's more aimed at helping Alina. So in my World War One flying world, if they've got a parachute, it's to get out of a burning aeroplane before they die and turn into burnt bacon, human bacon. So yeah. When does it change? When do we go from pretty much not having parachutes and then sort of figuring out they're a good escape mechanism to using them as part of operations?
Well, we, that is the Brits, took a long time to get our heads around this, and it wasn't until 1940, and I'll come on to that in a second, but actually the Italians were the first ones to use parachutes, and it was end of the 1920s. And they developed a parachute that they thought was reasonably reliable and that could be used to insert troops behind enemy lines, which is the whole point of airborne, really, isn't it? If you think of it, it's the extra dimension to warfare. A real game changer in many ways, but a ridiculously inefficient way to go to war, as I know we're going to discuss, because really you've got two options. You either come in by the parachute, and as you're suggesting, Alex, is, you know, this was a last resort for most people. So why on earth would you actually choose to use it? And in great numbers, of course, too, because, you know, if you just go in, there are 10 of you with your parachutes, that's not going to make much difference, is it?
So, but like, there's a big difference between I have to use this thing, otherwise I will die, I'm voluntarily, for a bit of extra money every month, going to log myself out of a plane whenever they tell me to.
Well, it was really a question of who was going to get there first and what were they going to use it for. And I suppose if you think about it, it's not a coincidence that the people who had the most to gain out of developing their military in the 1930s, and that, of course, is Italy, Japan, Germany, of course, and Russia to a certain extent, Soviet Russia, which was still, you know, kind of persona non grata to most of the rest of the world. Those are the militaries looking to get an edge. It's not a coincidence, too, of course, that Germany develops the armored warfare in a much more aggressive sense, hence Blitzkrieg by the beginning of the Second World War. And I suppose you've got to think of the development of airborne by a lot of those powers as a same sort of idea. So how can we get one over the traditional militaries who've got, you know, developed economies, and sooner or later their armed forces are going to be a tough nut to crack. The Germans, of course, even in 1940, thought it would be difficult to defeat the French. So they're trying to use every trick in the book, and one of them was airborne. The Brits were incredibly slow, as I've suggested, and really only thought of planes as a means of bringing in supplies and maybe landing troops, but certainly not delivering them from the air. And this all changes in 1940.
Well, this brings us nicely to my next question, because both me and Alex went through your book. You got five main parts, and then I popped you a message and I said, listen, we want to be different. We don't want to be like every other podcast. We have to do something out of the box. And you haven't done much on the beginnings and how it all became and how and why parachutists or the British created this parachute brigade. So tell us about that, because who in their right mind, like Alex has said, is going to be jumping out of a plane?
Well, it was really a matter of desperation, to be truthful, Alina, because the timing, the date is vital, isn't it? 5th of June 1940, Churchill asked for the creation of 5,000 paratroopers, and we didn't have any. We didn't even have parachutes that we knew that worked. We certainly didn't have planes that were designed to drop parachuters. But what Churchill had noticed in the disastrous Low Countries campaigns is that Germany had actually used their airborne troops, both glider and paratroopers, quite effectively. I mean, I think they were slightly oversold, to be truthful. You've got the famous incidents like the capture of the Eben-Emel fortress in Belgium, which was a success. But some of the other drops of parachutists did not go quite so well. But nevertheless, Churchill's desperate. This is post-Dunkirk. Britain is now on its own. It's looking for a way to strike back against the enemy. And he's thinking outside the box. So first of all, he says, let's have some commandos who can attack from the sea. Those are going to be amphibious troops. But he also wants paratroopers. And it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that the very first parachute unit is also commando trained. So it's second commando, which becomes second commando later on, the first parachute battalion. And that's the unit that carries out the first mission. But I can't stress how completely chaotic these early months were. No one really knew what they were doing. They didn't have the right kit. They didn't understand how it worked. There was no center to train parachutists. They had to start it from scratch. And here's the really interesting bit. There was a lot of inter-service rivalry because the RAF, of course, was really thinking in terms of strategic bombing. And if they're going to create this airborne force, particularly if it gets sizable, and Churchill had asked for 5,000, although it takes a while to get anywhere near that number, they are going to have to devote a serious number of planes to deliver them. I mean, I'll just give you a quick statistic. During D-Day, which we've promised not to talk about because that's what everyone else wants to ask me about, given the anniversary coming up, the two US airborne divisions, that's, let's say, about 15, 16,000 men, 800 planes, 800 sizable planes are needed to deliver them. So the RAF are thinking, you know, blow me down. The last thing we want is this airborne force. First of all, we're going to have to, you know, teach them to parachute. We don't really know what we're doing. And then secondly, we're going to have to deliver them. And that's going to involve an awful lot of kit. So if it wasn't for Churchill absolutely staying on this and coming back to this again and again, and let's face it, he's got other things on his mind, I suspect the airborne experiment, as it was known in the early years, would have withered on the vine. But fortunately, Churchill did stay on it. Every kind of 2 or 3 months, he'd say, what's going on with the paratroopers? Where are we? And someone would come back, well, you know, because of capacity and because of training, we've only got 300 guys, you know, who were ready to go. And then it was 500. But slowly but surely, he insisted on not only developing paratroopers, but also gliders, which, as I mentioned, the Germans had used quite effectively at Eben-Emel. So in the end, you had a relatively balanced force. That was the idea. You were going to have a brigade of air landing, as it was called, and they would come in by gliders. And you'd have two brigades of parachutists, and that would make up an airborne division. But it's going to take an awful long time before even the first British Airborne Division, which, of course, had that number, the first, was created and went into action.
So I'm supposed to ask you about the recruits next, but in true History Hack style, I'm going to go off on a tangent first. Just for the layman, you mentioned there that the need that this huge undertaking involves aircraft as well. For the layman, why can't we just take existing aeroplanes up and shove them out?
Yeah, well, good question. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. How actually do you get a parachutist out of the plane? Now, when a plane's sitting on the ground and, you know, and the pressure's all equal, then you can open the door and that's fine. And you file on, you go up the steps and you file on. But actually getting someone off a plane is really, really difficult when you're moving at speed. And the heights were really scary, actually. Think of this, Alex and Alina. I mean, roughly 400 to 600 feet they would drop from. And that's really only giving you a few seconds. So if anything goes wrong, if there's any delay in getting that parachute open, you are going to die. And a lot of people did die parachuting in.
So
was an
if you don't do that, though, they're going to drop too far apart, aren't they? If you're
they're going to drop too far apart. So the point about the exit is it has to be something that you can get out nice and smoothly, one after the other. They work out, actually, one of the great developments with parachutes is they work out you need a static line, which is basically an automatic system for them opening. So you hook up to it. Everyone's seen the films, no doubt, of The Longest Day, where they all hook up to this line. And as you jump out, you don't have to do anything. It just opens automatically for you. You have a reserve pull. Which means if the initial hook hasn't worked, you've got a chance of opening your parachute. You've got to do it very quickly. But here's another interesting fact. The Americans went all the way through the Second World War with a reserve chute for the very good reason. If the first chute fails, they've got a reserve and, you know, and it's going to save their lives. They hope. The Brits only ever had, and the Poles for that matter, Alina, only ever had a single parachute. And of course, if that fails, you're a goner. But to get back to the point about the planes, in the early days they were jumping out of Whitleys and Stirlings. They're not designed, and Halifax bombers, they're not designed for dropping parachutes. So they literally cut a hole in the floor. They actually they had a look at, they experimented with taking off the tail gunners thing and jumping out from there, but that didn't work very well. And they reckon the next best thing was actually just dropping through a hole in the floor. But it's very inefficient if you think about it. You know, you've got to sit on the hole and then drop out one after the other, and it's going to take a lot more time. And as you quite rightly,
they're weighed down, aren't they? Rifles, they're weighed down.
They've got enormous amounts of kit. The other point about parachuters is they have to take everything with them, so they're loaded down with lots of stuff. They actually work out the best thing to do is have a bag that's attached to you and you drop below you. So that means you can probably take a little bit more weight, and also it's not going to be a really heavy collision when you hit the ground, because it's going to hit the ground first. So that was quite a clever system. I mean, the other way, of course, is to drop out your kit separately, but then it gets blown all over the place. So the real issue, which they hadn't really solved right up until the end of the Second World War, is to drop hundreds, indeed thousands of parachutists and hope they're all going to arrive in roughly the same place. It never really worked.
Yeah, I feel like the trapdoor in the bottom of the plane should have Acme stamped on it.
Well, because of the sort of characters who went into parachuting, I mean, you could just imagine. I mean, this is seriously dangerous stuff, okay? First point.
Yeah, this is what I want to ask you now, is that, like, so there, you can't go, I need experienced parachuters, because they don't exist.
No.
And it's like World War One. They were like, right, so what do we do? Okay, just find me young, stupid kids with no concept of their own mortality who are good at sport or fixing things. What's the perfect idea of a parachutist when they start?
Yeah, they want young, fit. They want everything, actually. I mean, if you look at the list of attributes, they want people who are good with, you know, who are good with motor engines, which, you know, we see that as fairly straightforward these days. But in the context of the Second World War, you know, only a certain number of young kids would have had any experience with engines. But they want them to be fit. They want them to be good shots. They want them to, you know, to be malleable enough to teach new tricks to, but also be independent-minded enough to be able to understand the psychological shock of fighting as an airborne soldier, which means you're basically on your own. You've got the kit.
Yeah,
you can take
it,
with you.
Isn't it?
The weapons. That psychological thing of actually fighting behind enemy lines is a really underestimated key element in their psychological makeup. Because so you need a team player. They've got to be able to fight together, but they've also got to be not completely rigid with fear. If they happen to land, you know, half a mile away from the rest of the guys, and they've got to use their own resources to get back to them. So it's a really interesting combination. The sort of people probably that would go into special forces, but you really need an awful lot of them. So you can't be quite as choosy as, let's say, the SBS or the SAS were. But certainly they were looking in the early days for mavericks, some oddballs, you know, daredevils, if truth be told.
Yeah.
It probably, as the war went on, they got a little bit more regimented in their thinking, and they became a little bit more structured in the way they trained them, more to do with infantry tactics rather than, you know, almost guerrilla fighting. But nevertheless, they never entirely lost the need to get these, you know, really resourceful daredevil characters who were prepared to undertake missions which, you know, had pretty frightening casualty rates. I mean, there was a very, very good chance you weren't going to come back from any single airborne operation, or at least you weren't going to escape uninjured.
Yeah, I think, like, even like someone who's not versed in this, if you've just seen Band of Brothers and you've seen Day of Days, just watch Damian Lewis's character. Nothing goes right. He has to adapt constantly. They're not in the right place. They're scattered, separated. He's got men that aren't his with him. I mean, it really is something quite, like you say, the psychological effect of being chucked behind enemy lines. So how do you train them for that? Obviously, they need to practice jumping a lot. But how do you, like you say, how do you balance them sort of getting thousands of these guys ready with a kind of independence to go it alone as well?
Yeah, well, in the early days, they had a lot of psychological tests, actually, interesting. It was psychological and physical tests for you to even get over the hurdle to go into the training. And then you went, then you did your jumps. I mean, you say, well, of course, you know, they're going to do a lot of parachute training. Actually, they only ever did 6 or 7 jumps. And that was it. Then you got your wings and then you're ready to go. And to be truthful, they're not practicing jumps that much thereafter. Why? Because it's expensive to do. You need a lot of planes to do it. And it's dangerous, you know. So it's almost better once they're fully qualified to actually drop them next in action itself. And the same way for the gliders.
Sorry, I was going to ask, would they have the infantry training before they then went on to the parachute training?
Well, the two went hand in hand. I mean, the initial idea is everybody who joins the paratroopers has to have a level of infantry training. But of course, they then top that up with their own specific training, not least when they had a mission. So, for example, Operation Colossus, the very first mission carried out by what became the first parachute battalion, was attacking a small aqueduct in southern Italy. And there were very specific jobs that everyone had to do. Some of them had to carry in explosives. And then, of course, there was the exfiltration, because the other big problem with any of these missions, Alex, is that it's one thing getting them there, and that's bad enough. But it's a totally different matter actually getting them out. I mean, eventually, by the end of the Second World War, they worked out, let's not drop our paratroopers too far away from the ground forces that are acting in coordination with them. So this type of mission that they had at the beginning of the war, Operation Biting, is another example. That wonderful grabbing of the German radar on the north coast of France, again, was a sort of one-off mission. You go it, you do the job, and you try and get them out if you can. They were very successful actually getting them back, mainly because they were on the coast and they could bring them out with the Navy. That operation I mentioned before, Colossus, they're right in the middle of Italy and they've got to march 50 miles to the coast. And you know, the chances of doing that when you're a bunch of bloody foreign soldiers armed to the teeth are vanishingly small. So I think they realized slowly but surely, if you're going to drop them somewhere, they've got to be dropped where either boats or ground forces can get to them. And of course, that's the classic error, as we all know, that they made at Arnhem, because Arnhem really came about as a result of the success of D-Day. And they thought, you know what, these guys are amazing. We can give them these seemingly impossible missions and we'll just get the ground forces to them sooner or later. I mean, what they forget is they're so lightly armored paratroopers and glider troops. They can't take heavy artillery with them, for example. They don't have any serious kind of engineering kit. So that in the end, they can only hold off a strong force, an armored force, for a relatively short period of time. So that those 64 miles between the border where the ground troops started and where Arnhem, the furthest bridge, was, I mean, simply too far to get in 2 days along a single track road. So it was learning those lessons, but getting help to airborne troops was always, you know, the real conundrum, as much as getting them in there and showing them the job and training them to fight in the first place.
Yeah, we're going to get back to Colossus in a minute, because I know we want to talk you through some of the non-D-Day adventures that nobody else is asking you about, because they're only asking you about D-Day. But you just mentioned how lightly armoured they are. This is the thing, isn't it? So do they, and also as well, like, there's no huge chain of command. So are we looking at sort of at most operating at like platoon level once they get on the ground realistically by the time they've all landed?
I mean, it depends. It depends which operation. In the early days, there was only a battalion. I mentioned it, the 1st Parachute Battalion, as it becomes originally 2nd Commando. And that's only 500 strong. And the first mission that I also mentioned, Colossus, that's only a single troop of 2 Commando that goes in. So you're only talking about 35 men involved in that operation, and it's led by a major. So, you know, that's basically platoon level. But as the war goes on and they get more ambitious and they begin to think, hold on a second, if we drop enough airborne, we can give them really grandiose objectives. We can try and get them to hold bridges for a considerable period of time, well behind enemy lines. And then, as I say, when the ground forces get to them, this can be a real game changer. And they tried that properly for the first time in Sicily. Doesn't work very well, I have to say. But again, they're kind of learning on the job. I mean, one of the interesting things about writing the book about the whole war, I mean, loads of people have written books about individual missions, and loads of people have written books about Arnhem and even D-Day and Pegasus Bridge. But rarely are all the different threads of the story tied together in a way that I've done with this book. And it's interesting as an author to see the development, to see the sort of learning process, to see the errors and mistakes and cock-ups and incompetent commanders. You know, one of the reviewers said, I think it was in the Times, said it's unbelievable how poorly led they were by the senior commanders, not by the battalion commander, not by the guys they used to train with. But just one other quick point about officers in the parachute battalion, but also in the gliders, is that they very much led by example. I mean, these were guys who, you know, were right there at the front. There's a moment, famous moment during the Pegasus Bridge operation, where I keep saying I'm not going to talk about D-Day and keep coming back to it, where first guy over the bridge, you know, the first guy over the bridge is a lieutenant, and he gets shot in the throat and killed. You know, so they really did lead from the front. And I can't tell you how important that is. You know, all the study of war I've done, Devil Dogs, my book about the Marines and the Pacific. I mean, when there was a bad officer, it affects the whole unit. I mean, we all know that. We all know it's true. But the better the unit, the more impact a really good officer can have. And the parachute battalion officers, not without exception, there were some bad apples, of course, which sneaked in. But generally speaking, were really, really good. And a lot of the guys who you see entering the story right at the beginning, people like Frost, Pearson, Hill, all of these guys go on to have careers. I mean, luckily they don't get killed, but they have careers all the way through the war. And you see them, you know, doing multiple missions because they get so good at what they do.
Before we start booting them out of planes and having fun with that, can I be a complete nerd?
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Yep, sure thing.
I know there's other nerds out there that want me to ask this question as well. So before we talk about the actual operations, you mentioned development there. So how did that change in terms of what they're kicked out of the plane wearing? So I'm guessing at the beginning they sit down and they go, right, they need food, they need water, they need a map, they need a gun. But how does that then change as the requirements change for the operations and they start getting ridiculous, grandiose ideas like Arnhem?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think the kit that they take changes that much. It's the way that it's delivered really that changes. Right at the beginning, as I think I mentioned, they would try and drop the kit separate from the soldiers. Obviously, you've got your personal kit. You've got your personal weapons. You've got your basic iron rations.
Like, no, I am not going to end up 3 miles. If I was an officer, I was like, no, I'm not going to be roaming the countryside looking for my weapons. No.
Yeah. Well, they developed a bag which basically stayed attached to you. So obviously you're not going to be carrying your weapon as you parachute. You know, you've got other things to be doing with your hands, but you do need it very close to you when you land.
You just do a death roll on the floor and pop
exactly
up.
Exactly. You do sometimes get that image, don't you, that they're almost firing as they're coming down. And the other point about that is, of course, because they don't have their weapons, obviously they are really vulnerable, and you do get many instances all the way through the story of Airborne, where they're literally just shot in the air, which is why The glider guys actually thought, do you know what? I'd prefer to be in a glider. I mean, gliders were ridiculously dangerous. I mean, they crash land. They are made of wood and steel and fabric.
Have a plane without a proper engine. Ta-da!
Exactly. Like, I mean, it's just, it's hurtling. It's hurtling. There's a funny moment when one of the glider operations where the officer's looking out the window and he can see sparks flying all, it's just coming into land. You can see sparks flying. Oh my God, we're under fire. You know, they're going to shoot us to pieces. Actually, it's the skids of the glider just striking stones on the stony ground and just sending these sparks everywhere. But they give you an idea of the sort of, you know, the velocity and the impact. I mean, they're going 80, 90 miles an hour when they hit the ground. And, you know, good luck if you're going to survive that. And a lot of glider troops did not survive. So it was, take your poison, really. But to go back to your question, I mean, depending on what the operation was and how long they were expected to be there was how much kit they took with them. But as the missions became more strategic, more like D-Day, more like Arnhem, and more like Operation Varsity, the very last one of the war when they're jumping the Rhine, they do need more kit because they're expected to hang out there for longer. So they need more food and they need more ammunition, crucially. So that's when they'd use these really extra big bags that they take with them, which they would drop beneath them as they were parachuting down. So that's really the key difference. The personal kit didn't change. Although I've got a little passage at the beginning of the book where I describe what a single parachutist on one of the missions takes with him. And it's about 40 items long. And a lot of these guys, there are multiple descriptions where they literally have to be pushed onto the planes. They are so overladen with kit, they can hardly move. They're like the Michelin man, kind of, you know, waddling around. But they understandably felt the more kit we take with us, certainly the more ammunition we take with us, the better.
It's amazing, isn't it? Figuring out the logistics that go with it. We could probably prattle on like absolute boring nerds all day about the logistics of this, but let's not. Let's talk to people about the adventure stuff. So we've already referenced Colossus a fair bit. So this is the first one.
Yeah.
And it's Italy. 50 miles, no thank you, behind enemy lines.
Yeah, it's nuts.
So what is the plan?
Well, it was ambitious, like a lot of the early plans were. And as I said, you know, overambitious plans were really the death knell for a lot of people. And do you know what? It's really, really interesting. This will sum up the psychology. It was a mad plan. I mean, there was almost no chance they were going to get away. And do you know what? The 35 people who volunteered for this mission, there were another 450 people who were disappointed they didn't get the job. I mean, they were so jealous that X-Troop, as it was called, they even give them a new name, especially for the mission. They were so jealous that they were, you know, trying to convince their commanding officer that they should go instead of these guys. So, I mean, it's really interesting that however dangerous the mission was, it didn't put off anyone from wanting to go on it. And in a nutshell, they're going to drop into the mountains in Italy with explosives. There are some airborne engineers with them, airborne sappers, you know, the elite of the elite, if you really think about it, the airborne sappers were. These are, you know, really capable Swiss Army knife type soldiers. And they've got the single most important job, which is to lay the charges. So what happens at Operation Colossus? All the engineers go astray. Not all the explosives, but all the engineers go astray, which of course is happening all the time. So what they actually have to do is the guys who aren't trained in explosives have to lay what explosives they've got left. And they've only got about, I think, a third of what they'd originally planned to use. And yet, nevertheless, they managed to blow this aqueduct. So why is there a target of an aqueduct? Because this is the single main source of water for the whole of southeast Italy, the whole of the province of Apulia. And the British High Command in its wisdom is thinking, if we can knock out the water supply to these key ports like Taranto, we can
So this is the foot, isn't it? And the quickest route
to
Sicily.
Foot. It's right at the bottom. And the reason it's important is because those ports, I mean, Taranto is one of the main naval ports in Italy at that time. And a lot of resupply for the campaign in Albania and also North Africa is coming through to Taranto. So that's really the job. It's to dry up the water, make Taranto unusable and really mess up the Italians' ability to fight. Well, they do blow up the aqueduct. They almost all get captured by peasants, Italian peasants. There's this kind of hilarious moment, this kind of semi-comic moment when they do have an opportunity to fight their way out, and they certainly could have killed a few peasants, but they just think to themselves, what's the point? You know, we'll be killing civilians. We're probably not going to get away. There's a hue and cry on us now. So they do hand themselves in, although the commanding officer says, you know, he's never been more embarrassed in his life when he has to surrender to these.
By some old bloke with a pitchfork.
Got a shotgun, literally shotgun wielding Italian country types. But does the mission have any real effect? Hardly. I mean, they knock out the water supply for about 5 or 6 days, then the Italians repair it, and life goes on as normal. So was it all worth it? Well, yes, interesting enough, because it proves that you can deliver parachute troops to do a job. That was successful. Yes, we didn't get them away, but we're going to have to think harder about that. But the other important thing is, if you think about this early battleground between, you know, the people who were convinced that airborne was a thing and would be useful in the future, and everybody else, they were able to say, no, look, we've got something that was successful. So I think in a PR sense for the airborne experiment, it was really important to be able to show actually they got to their target and they knocked it out. And one extra thing, which you often forget with airborne, is that airborne is as much moral as it is physical, which is warfare in general, I know, but in particular airborne, because it has this psychological effect that means the enemy doesn't ever know where you're coming. And it means it has to double its defenses all over the place. And the same was going on, frankly, in 1944 when the Germans were expecting attacks. And Montgomery used to say, just having airborne divisions and not using them, is a benefit, because the Germans are always devoting resources to where they think they might be sent rather than where they actually are sent. So I think it was the moment where people were reasonably confident that airborne was going to continue.
Yeah. And also as well, I've just mocked us for being interested in the logistics, but we are trying to hit their logistics. And like you said, it's the same as the Arab revolt hitting the railway with T. Lawrence in 1917 and 18, isn't it? It's like, no, we have tiny numbers compared to you and not really much weaponry or anything, but we do have bombs and we will blow up your railway when you least expect it and you don't know when it's coming. And it does absolutely, I don't know what your stats are on like some of the bigger operations on this, but I know on that it reduces eventually the traffic on that railway and the logistics for the Turks down in Medina by half. So yeah, I mean, that really messed them up.
It's a really good analogy. I think what's interesting about the airborne in the Second World War is that they never concentrate on a single target long enough for you ever to see any real long-term effects. But we do know from a lot of contemporary evidence from the Axis side, the Germans and the Italians, that they are constantly worried about where airborne might be used. And they are therefore having to dissipate their defenses all over the place. Anti-aircraft guns, of course, which were used as defense for strategic bombing, also being put all over the place where they think airborne might come in for obvious reasons, because, you know, airborne are most vulnerable where they're either coming down or where they're just about to drop. I mean, if you can get a troop transport with paratroopers on it, it's a nice, fat, juicy target. So, the fact that the Axis had to devote a lot of resources to potentially combating airborne is a important point that's often forgotten. People will still argue, by the way, Alex, to this day, that airborne didn't, you know, it was a waste of money. It didn't really have any effect. And they usually mention Arnhem and one or two other things, probably Colossus, without really seeing the big picture. And, I had to overcome or at least tackle similar arguments when it came to the SBS, because there are always these people, particularly traditionalists, who don't like special forces. They just don't like their style. They don't like their way of thinking. They think things should be done properly.
No, but the thing is, it's just a cricket, is it? No, you should just go at them like going hurrah over the top and kicking a football. But it is the essence of guerrilla warfare.
Much happier. I mean, you've summed it up. I mean, the idea that they can't run on the first day of the Somme, which I used to think they've got to have made that up, but they really didn't make that up. They had to move at a certain speed, didn't they? Otherwise, things are going to get a little bit out of order, you know. I mean, it's just total madness. So, bring me, left field thinking, outside the box thinking any day of the week, because warfare, I'm afraid, is very predictable. And the other side, if the other side knows what you're doing, it can counteract it pretty easily.
I never forget doing a thing at a private school where health and safety wasn't quite as rigid as, they did a risk assessment, but we put 60 pounds of gym weights in a backpack and strapped them to a 14-year-old girl, but like the weight a soldier would have been carrying on the first day of Somme, and went, all right, run, while all of the boys throw rugby balls at you, they're artillery shells. And she had to do a lap of the auditorium. And the first thing she said when she fell at my feet at the end was, I think I just died 5 times. So, yeah.
Yeah, by the way, that's that's such a good. I remember doing a documentary years ago in which they said, "Oh, you've got to, you've actually got to experience a lot of what these guys went through." I mean, you know, I wasn't getting any younger in those days, Alex. And that was a good 10 years ago. And I remember them putting 120 pounds on my back because we were doing this item about the Falklands, where the Marines carried up to 120 pounds. I could hardly move. I mean, honestly, I could hardly take one step in front of the other. And they were saying, well, they was 18, 21, 22 guys were carrying this stuff for hour after hour. And it was a real eye opener. So yeah, that actual experience of getting stuff on you and seeing what it feels like. And you can't even get close to the psychological, debilitation of mortal threats all around you, of course, in civilian life. But even just feeling the weight's quite useful.
Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me that when you're doing stuff about units and individual units and going into battle, it doesn't matter what war, like you always think like you've been through all this epic training, you're ready, and then you are never 100% when you actually have to fight for your life. You won't have slept, you'll be knackered, you'll be terrified, nothing will go according to plan because it never does. So actually the fact that you'll be trying to employ all of that training in really negative circumstances where you're not set up to do your best as well, I don't think people ever grasp that. But you, with Colossus, so they've started with that's a really focused thing. We want to blow up one water supply with 35 men. That's a concentrated target, very definitive. What about Op Biting, which is February 42 in France? Is that more of the same, or do they go for something completely different?
It's more of the same, but there is a specific... it's more the same, but it's much more achievable. I mean, it's closer to home for starters. It's right next to the coast. The plan is to steal what is a crucial and very new bit of German radar. They've got this early warning radar, which basically identifies planes as they're coming into France. Not only that, it directs fighters onto them and anti-aircraft fire. So it was a very sophisticated bit of kit, and we needed to get hold of it so we could look at it and work out how to counteract it. And very
is
ambitious
that the driving
plan.
Factor, or is it we need something less ridiculous than what we tried to do last time? Or is the
it was? I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, they also realized, you train these guys up to a certain level, I mean, you can't suddenly replace them. I mean, one of Frost, who leads Operation Biting, John Frost, who goes on to Arnhem fame, of course, he's commanding two para at Arnhem, and his job is to capture Arnhem Bridge. So he's got the single most important and hardest job at Arnhem. And it's not a coincidence because he's proven his worth in operations like Biting. But Frost, worked out a plan that was achievable, which is you drop relatively close to the target. You drop at night, so it's dangerous, but it was actually in winter, February 1942, and there was snow on the ground, which is quite useful because it breaks your fall. And what you see with paratroopers all the time is they're breaking their ankles, they're twisting their knees. I mean, they're literally hopping to the battlefield. But in this particular case, most of his guys were all right. Some went astray, as they always did. But it was almost a textbook operation. They took casualties, not serious. They got away with most of the radar, all the key bits they wanted to get, because they literally had to unbolt it. And they brought back, and here's the real kicker, two prisoners of war, one of whom was an operator of the radar. So they were able to then interrogate him. And I've seen the transcript of the interrogation. And I mean, he sings like a canary. It's hilarious. There's none of this, I'm not going to tell you anything, name, rank, and number. I mean, he's like, whatever you want to know, I'll tell you. And within a really short period of time, and it's in almost all the books about the RAF, there's been recent books about this, who've covered the story. And it really did make a difference. So when I talked about Colossus being the first important moment, this is the next really important moment, because Churchill is heavily involved in the whole operation. He's briefed by Frost when Frost returns, and he is super impressed. And of course, it's an example to him of, validation for him setting up this force in the first place. Definitely gives Airborne another kind of shot in the arm, and leads to increasingly ambitious projects, because the reason they're only doing raids at the beginning, in a nutshell, Alex, is because they don't have enough men to do anything else. But as soon as you get brigades together, and then more than that, divisions, you're going from 3,000 to, I don't know, let's say 10,000 men, then you can have really ambitious objectives, which is really what they were beginning to think about, not so much North Africa, but Sicily. After North Africa and Sicily is where they really begin to get things going. North Africa's a bit of a blip because the commander then, a man called Browning, a boy Browning, married to Daphne du Maurier, the novelist, sometimes known as Mr. du Maurier, because she was much more famous than him. Boy Browning actually does very badly at Arnhem. He's the corps commander there. But in the years leading up to that, he's very much the driving force behind these ambitious projects. Let's use the guys, let's use more of them, and let's use them in conjunction with ground forces, which they try to do a bit of in North Africa. It doesn't really work because they don't have enough planes, but they then begin to get brigade-sized objectives for the first time in Sicily.
So why is, before we talk about those bigger operations then, when we're going up to brigade level, why is Op Freshman in November 1942 important?
Well, it's important because it's the first glider operation. So, you know, you think that the paras have had their chance in early 41, and it's not until the end of 42 that they find a suitable target for gliders. And again, it's not a big operation. There's a relatively small number of guys. They're going to go in two gliders, but they're being taken from Scotland to Norway. I mean, think how nuts that is. So they've got to tug them, because gliders obviously have to be taken most of the way by planes with propellers. That's how they work. They've got to tug them all the way across the North Sea. So that's a 500-mile journey, at least 3.5 hours in the air. And then they've got to drop them over Norway and hope they're going to insert into a mountainous region of Norway. And why are they going there? Because they're trying to knock out heavy water. Heavy water the Germans were developing for use with their nuclear weapons program. So it was a really important target. And it's a target that some of your listeners will probably know is later achieved successfully. And I'm giving the game away a little bit, by, of course, the heroes of Telemark. And those are Norwegian SOE operatives who do the job. But this original plan to send in two gliders full of airborne engineers to blow up the heavy water plant, which is the Norsk Hydro, in a place called Rjukan, which is west of Norway, it seemed a fairly sensible plan. But unfortunately, when they did it, which is the winter of 1942 or the early winter of 1942, really bad weather conditions, which always affect gliders, and both gliders crash in the wrong place, so they're nowhere near the target. Some of the guys are already killed in the crash, and the ones who aren't are rather tragically handed over to the Germans by scared local Norwegians who, you know, want nothing to do with them and obviously fear for their lives if they hide them themselves. And they're all murdered by the Germans on the commander order. In fact, they are the first victims of the commander, the infamous Führerbefehl, the commando order, which of course meant, in effect, any Allied troops found behind enemy lines on secret operations, are liable to be murdered. And that's what happened.
So you've already mentioned North Africa. Why is North Africa significant when we're looking at like a broad history of airborne forces?
Well, North Africa is the first time that they go in any force. So we've now got the first parachute brigade operational. Mm. I mean, it's probably about 2,000 strong if you put engineers and medics and everything together. And each of the battalions, made up of three parachute battalions, first, second, and third. And each one of those is about 500 strong. So think of a force of about 2,000. And that's as big as it got. And if we think that the North African campaign begins, or at least as far as the parachuters, it begins in late 1942 with Operation Torch. Browning, who I mentioned before, who is in overall command of British airborne troops, is absolutely convinced that if they go in as a whole brigade, they can really make a difference. And of course, what you got quite early on in the Torch campaign is the so-called race for Tunis. The French were collapsing. The Allies were trying to get to Tunis to stop the Germans and the Italians from reinforcing or at least landing troops in Tunisia so that they could then stop Rommel's army from being crushed by both sides. It was an absolutely key moment, and Browning felt we can use airborne. If we drop a whole brigade, maybe they can capture Tunis on their own. But the orders were never given, sadly. There weren't enough transport. It was felt that the Germans had command of the air, which they did in the early stages of Torch. And so they're only used on relatively minor drops, battalion-sized drops, none of which are that effective. There's one that captures Airfield, and that goes quite well. That's the 3rd Parachute Battalion. But the other two are really wasted. They're frittered away. But where the 1st Parachute Brigade really does begin to show its worth is in ground fighting. So if you think of airborne as really having three main roles in the Second World War, One of the roles is these little missions that we've already discussed, the raids. The third one is the big strategic role, which of course comes on, which they do very well at D-Day and Varsity. But the middle ground one is that you literally just use them as ground infantry. It's not what they're designed for, but if you think of their, you know, their aggression and their ability to fight as, you know, in small groups, you can see they're going to be very, very effective at small unit level, either in a defensive situation or an offensive situation. And certainly the senior commanders in Tunisia felt, and I'm just writing about this at the moment, actually, Alex, in my new book, Tunis Grad, felt that, you know, give me a unit of airborne troops over normal infantry any day, even though they don't have artillery and all the other support systems. They are just far and away the best infantry troops we've got. And you could say the same about the Polish paratroopers. And of course, you know, and the Germans, by the way, their full Sturmjäger, of course, famously are involved in the capture of Crete, but are never used in an airborne capacity thereafter. But they are used as ground troops very effectively at Montecassino and elsewhere. So you see that the training that goes into producing and the sort of individual soldier and the motivation you get from these airborne troops, they are very, very effective soldiers.
Well, it's like you're siphoning off. Like, so I remember talking to someone who was Special Forces, and he was saying that sort of in any unit, you've got, say, you've got 100%. You've got sort of 50% of them are okay soldiers that need leading and won't do anything on their own. And then like 30% of them will be functional, good soldiers who can obey commands and stuff. And then you've got your Special Forces stuff. And the top 5% are like the psychopaths that make the absolute best soldiers. And I guess like this is the upper percentage, isn't it, that have been siphoned off for the paratroopers.
Yeah, they're all volunteers. And actually, you have hit the nail on the head in terms of why Special Forces are so unpopular. Because if you run a normal infantry battalion, those 10% of guys who are actually the doers in the battalion, they've gone. They've gone to the paras. They've gone to the commandos. They've gone to Special Forces. So that it's true that that is a logical reason why you would discourage people from joining Special Forces. And every single person who goes into airborne, when he tells his unit commander he wants to volunteer, they try and stop them. And of course, ultimately they can't, but they put all kinds of pressure on them and say, well, you'll drop in rank and good chance you're going to be killed. None of which is going to deter them, by the way. Well, it's like a red rag.
It is like, I think you were going to say like a red rag to a bull, but also as well, it's like people go, oh, these Special Forces guys are dicks. Yeah, it's what makes them so good. It's like when people talk about First World War generals and they're like, he was really mean. And they're like, of course he was. He's at the top of the army. He's literally kicked and spat on everyone to get there. You think like, it's like when people are surprised that billionaires aren't nice people.
Yes, or heads of, you know, FTSE 100 companies, exactly right. I mean, without question.
Oh, he's not nice, really.
Alex, you and I are far too nice ever to go to the top of anything. You know, where we go to the top of podcasting, you know, probably not. I think you've got to be utterly ruthless and absolutely willing to trample on the next man. You know, and even though a lot of these airborne guys come out of the end of the Second World War, as I've said, people like Frost, you know, with tremendous reputations, they were so single-minded and so determined to carry out their mission, yes, but of course get the job in the first place. And that meant trampling over someone else. I mean, there's a lot of competition within these special units to be given the jobs. Why? Because they're all egotists. They all want the recognition, which is why, by the way, when I was working on my SBS book, it was quite unusual that they had a lot of the skill sets that we're talking about, but they didn't have the ego. It's almost like they deliberately chose people without the ego. And that, I think they're unique, really, among these special forces. Airborne, of course, traditionally have gone into the SAS. So that gives you a little bit of a clue as to the sort of mindset in the first place.
Yeah, nuts. Right. We have barely scratched the surface of what's in your book. Everyone's going to need to go and buy a copy. But I want to ask you one question where I let you just basically go rogue and say whatever you want. What was the most difficult operation to write about? Because some of these are quite niche, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, the most difficult one to write about was Arnhem, to be truthful. Why? Because a lot of it's already out there. And I'd read so much and I've seen so much. You know, visually, Arnhem's so familiar to us, isn't it? Not just the photographs, but of course, you know, the moments from the big films, the Bridge Too Far film, which came out probably well before you, well, certainly before you were born, Alex. But, you know, I remember when that was on at the cinema and the cast of stars in it. I mean, there were about 25 major stars, any one of which you could have held a single, you know, film on their own. Connery
is it like The Longest Hopkins Day, where everyone groveled to be in it? Like,
everybody wanted to be in it. Yeah. And you could bet your bottom dollar they weren't all being paid a king's ransom. It was just the film. And it's such a brilliant story of almost, you know, of, you know, all good history relies on jeopardy, of course. And, you know, I really hate it when people, and some historians to this day, still say, oh, well, it never could have succeeded. Of course, there were far too many things that could go wrong and did go wrong. And that's true up to a point. But history is all about happenstance. It's all about, you know, the little moment that changes everything. And you do get that in Arnhem. Yes, all the mistakes that people have spoken about are absolutely true. But there was an extraordinary kind of, I don't know, 12-hour period where if something had gone right at Nijmegen Bridge, and after all, the guys at Arnhem, through just sheer bloody-minded determination, had held on for 4 days instead of two, then it's possible the mission could have succeeded. So I think it got a lot closer to succeeding. But to be specific about your question, the difficulty is the material is very familiar. You know, the beats of the story are very familiar. So how do you tell it in a different way? And one of the ways I did that is because when I was thinking of writing the Sky Warriors in the first place, I was actually going to do a Band of Brothers, but British Airborne. So I was going to choose a company and follow it, obviously not just through Arnhem, but it was going to end up at Arnhem. Arnhem was going to be the climax. And so because I had a lot of the source material already mapped out, what I did is follow reasonably closely the story of a company to Para, which is the company really that holds the bridge. It's the company that's commanded by the wonderful, wonderfully named, but also wonderful character with his umbrella, and that's Tatum Water. They don't call him Tatum Water in the film, but they do have the umbrella in the film, if you remember. And he literally goes into war with his umbrella, and he's a wonderful character. And it's so I follow the story really through their eyes. Not to the exclusion of everything else, but it does allow a focus, because otherwise you can be drawn all over the place. What's happening with, you know, two para, and what's happening with the fourth parachute brigade, and then the Polish paratroopers come in, and the story is jumping around a lot. And when it's only, you know, a section of my book, you have to be a little bit more tightly focused. But even so, it was difficult. It was tricky finding something completely original until I realized actually the story, the disaster of Arnhem, had been oversold, and that some very respectable and responsible people actually had said at the time and had said since two things. One, it came very close to succeeding and almost succeeded. And secondly, because of that, because there was a chance that it really could have shortened the war, it was a risk worth taking. War is about casualties, I'm afraid. Better to lose 8,000 in an operation that could end the war by 6 months than not to try it in the first place. The idea that it couldn't have succeeded, that it was doomed from the start, I don't buy at all.
It's the justification for the bomb in the end, isn't it? We saved a million lives.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, that I think that is the problem. And people find it really hard to say, well, how on earth can you justify the loss of, you know, 2,000 paratroopers are killed. I mean, they're horrendous casualties. But they volunteered for a very dangerous job. Not a single person, I would suggest, who jumped at Arnhem didn't want to be there. In fact, he was, you know, his heart was beating. He was, you know, he was pleased as punch to be on a mission that was going to make them, and did make the ones who survived, you know, absolutely epic. What does Montgomery say afterwards? It would be a great thing for a man it would be a great thing for everybody who was involved and who survived to be able to say, I fought at Arnhem. And it's true, and it's still true.
Isn't it
today.
Like, you've got a ridiculous amount of people that claim to have been there, like to the point where there would have been 50,000 paratroopers going in at
exactly
Arnhem.
Right. I mean, I think all these, you know, all these special units, all these elite units, the wannabes jump. I mean, they hate it when someone impersonates them for obvious reasons, because it's bloody dangerous what they do, and they've lost a lot of good guys doing it. But It draws in these wannabes and these Walter Mitties, I'm afraid. And Anna is a classic. By the way, there are one or two published books that I am 99% sure are written by charlatans, and they don't always get picked up. You know, it's really shameful that people would do that, but they do.
I'd just say that if Sean Connery ends up playing you in a film, you haven't done too bad, have you?
No, I know. Hey, there is a funny little codicil, going back to D-Day for a second, and that is that the Pegasus Bridge operation, the guy involved was a guy called John Howard, as is well known. Wonderful character, born in a two-up, two-down house. And he was a working-class Londoner who made good, very determined, very ambitious, very focused and single-minded, and determined because of his relatively low social origins to be the best, to be better than all his fellow company commanders, who of course came from more traditional officer class backgrounds. And get this, he's played in the film The Longest Day by a man who was also at the bridge, fighting at the bridge, Richard Todd, who was in the 7th Parachute Battalion, which is the battalion sent to relieve the Oxenbucks, which Howard was commanding. And he is fantastically handsome, Richard Todd, you know, one of the great cinema idols. And in the best will in the world, you would say Howard was not. And so, you know, he was very lucky to have Todd casted him. There's a great picture of the two of them on the set of The Longest Day. And, very much underlines the point I'm making.
Yeah, well, it's like T. Lawrence, isn't it, being a foot and a half shorter than Peter O'Toole. So this has been absolutely amazing. Thank you very much. Sky Warriors, British Airborne Forces in the Second World War is a triumph, and it's out now. Congratulations.
Thanks, guys.
So that was absolutely fantastic. We always love having you on. It was such a pleasure. But to our listeners, don't forget, just to reiterate what Alex said earlier, we would love for you to go onto Apple and give us a 5-star review. Because, like we said, put in Chris is a big ginger man, Alina is awesome, Alex is stunningly gorgeous, and she's about to hit me around the head for saying that. But also remember, we've got a new website, which is www.historyhack.co.uk. It is fabulous. You can go and have a bit of a laugh. Alex has been very witty with her language. Truthful, but yet witty. Don't forget to also buy us a drink on Ko-fi. You don't have to give us the money, but it would be nice. It would be nice to, you know, get some money to be able to feed my dogs or, you know, fund my plant habit, which is getting completely out of control. And for that, you can hit us on ko-fi.com/historyhack.
Let's just say, like, plant habit. She's not growing marijuana, people. Literally pot plants. It's innocent. Like, Alina's not got like a row of lamps she's looking to fund in her flat in Warsaw. There's not a massive heat signal coming off of her flat.
No, she's actually, that is very true. Moving on, don't forget to subscribe if you like a little bit more content to our Patreon. You get some exclusive content, some cartoons drawn by our Beardy Weirdy, or some special quiz content. Go and have a look at that, which is on www.patreon.com/historyhack. And for you, I'm always going to end my lovely sort of spiel with a joke. So if you've gotten this far, well frigging done. So I'm going to tell you that I tried to make up a joke about a ghost, but I couldn't. It had plenty of spirit, but no body. Thanks very much, guys. Catch you all next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.